Bien, bonjour à toutes et à tous et bienvenue à la Fondation Maison des Sciences de l'Homme. Je ne vais pas être très long, mais je voudrais simplement peut-être contextualiser comment un livre arrive dans une bibliothèque, comment la bibliothèque allemande existe, et donc simplement remercier nos partenaires. Parce que c'est toujours une mission importante et parfois difficile de maintenir un dialogue franco-allemand malgré les apparences. La bibliothèque allemande y contribue et nous y tenons beaucoup. Donc je voudrais remercier, pardon, en m'excusant par avance pour mon accent allemand, le Deutsche Akademische Austauschdienst. Donc, plus connu en français sous le nom d'Office allemand d'échange universitaire, qui est un partenaire important de la Fondation, le Goethe-Institut, bien sûr aussi, le Centre Georges Simmel de l'École des hautes études en sciences sociales, qui, tous les trois, contribuent à la bibliothèque allemande et à cet événement. Et nous sommes très heureux de les avoir comme partenaires avec. Le Sierra hors les murs, donc le centre interdisciplinaire d'études et de recherches sur l'Allemagne. Toutes ces institutions, voilà, sont très importantes pour nous et j'insiste sur ce point. Je voudrais simplement aussi saluer la présence, donc, parmi nous, de ceux qui la représentent, Jean Lassaigue pour le centre Georges Simmel. Nicolas Heller pour le Goethe-Institut et Nathalie Faure pour le Sierra, ainsi que bien sûr la présidence de l'EHESS. Merci à tous de faire que cet événement soit possible et sans tarder, je vous cède la parole en vous remerciant de votre présence.
Merci à vous. Un grand merci. I'm going to switch to English, and I'm hoping that I'm able to switch to English in Paris. Thank you very much for the introduction. I'm going to continue kind of an introduction because I'd like to introduce to you Mr. Nathan Schneider. And the center of this conversation is going to be to present his book Fluchtpunkte der Erinnerung, which is going to be published in French with the title Mémoire en conflit. Nathan Schneider is born in Germany, in Mannheim, in 1954. I hope this is correct. And he emigrated,
Unfortunately.
and he, yeah, and he emigrated to Israel or went to Israel, migrated to Israel by the age of 20, so by 1974. And there are at least one or two book titles that I'd like to mention that Nathan Schneider published during his long-during career as a sociologist. For instance, the title The Holocaust and Memory in the Global Age in 2006, or Jewish Memory and the Cosmopolitan Order in 2011. What I want to mention with these two titles out of your work as a whole is that the topic of your new French book, Mémoire en Conflit, is not absolutely new to you. There is some work which preceded this book. I guess that's the most important aspects I wanted to mention to introduce you. And finally, I wanted to mention that Nathan Schneider and I, we got to know each other more than 20 years ago when I was a young editor at the WDR radio station in Cologne. And Nathan Schneider was not only a renowned sociologist, but he was also a political commentator of an intellectual commentator of political events back in the day, as he is today too. And we got to know each other in a new way with this book when it was published 3 years ago in German. 3 years ago, is that right? 2022, at the beginning of 2022, this was January 2022, and perhaps this would be my first question. We are going to talk a little bit about your book. I guess we will have a section talking about James Baldwin, the author James Baldwin II. This is one of your ideas for this event, for this evening. But the center is a presentation of your book, which was published 3 years ago. Now it's published in French. Of course, there's been a lot of events in the world, which is, in your view, looking at the topic of your book, which is the difference between 2022 and 2025? This is one way to ask my first question to you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me here this evening. And I also want to apologize. It's the first time in a long, long time that I speak about my things in English, and if it sounds a little bit rusty or with a heavy German accent, so it's actually fitting the event and all that. So I'm glad to be here. I'm also very, very grateful that this translation took place and see like your own book suddenly in a different language. And it's also fitting that the first translation of this book is in French, because it deals a lot with Paris, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later. Deals a lot with actors who speak and wrote in French, but it's a book written in German, and it's a book written to Germany. And it's a book that I wrote, that I started writing during Corona, and finished it during 21, and it came out in 22. It was sort of like a debate between that I sort of like staged. I wrote this book a little bit like a puppeteer who put on stage different thinkers and made them talk to each other, even though they didn't in real time. Some of them did, some of them didn't, but I made them talk to each other, and they all make an appearance in that book. Hannah Arendt, who sort of like accompanies this book from beginning to end, but not only her, very important to me is Albert Memmi, and I will talk about him a little bit later. Claude Lanzmann, of course, Frantz Fanon, Aimé Césaire, from the French speaking, then also Edward Said and Du Bois from the English speaking world. And all of them make an appearance. James Baldwin, who should have made an appearance in that book, doesn't really appear. He appears in one small footnote, which is one of the shortcomings of that book, and one of the things I wanted to correct with that shortcoming, with the participation of René here, who has written a book, you can see it here in German, a biography of James Baldwin, sort of like putting James Baldwin on the German intellectual and cognitive map. And it, I think these two books speak to each other as well. Sort of like this is the setup. Sort of like it's all started with a very typical German event, and you have to understand this book in within the German context, where questions of anti-Semitism, questions of critique of Israel, questions of this kind, and we're talking about pre-October 7th, of course, because this book was published pre-October 7th, and for the French edition, I put another preface in there, sort of like trying to put October 7th into the context of this book. You're asking about what's different now, what's different then. I mean, this abyss was sort of like opening up, and I try to come to terms with it in the first 7-8 pages that I added to this book in the French edition, which are not in the German one. And the book started, I mean, what triggered that book was also a writer who wrote in French but is not French, Achille Mbembe, who was invited to a cultural big event in Germany to give the opening speech, and in the summer of 2020. And Achille Mbembe just became a very famous author in Germany. His translations in a very prestigious German publishing house, Suhrkamp, started to come one after the other, especially Critique de la Raison Nègre, which was translated as the Critique der Schwarzen Vernunft, the same title as in English, the Critique of Black Reasoning, not the Nègre. A French term could, of course, not be translated into German. It would have caused another shitstorm. But in that translation was the beginning of a new cultural field in Germany, which wasn't really around at that time, which is the field of black studies, post-colonial studies, which had sort of like a very, very low-key presence in German academia and also in German public life. And Achille Mbembe sort of like put it on the map. And before 2020, he actually received a very prestigious prize in Munich in Germany, which is called the Geschwister Scholl Preis. Now, this is also very iconic in the German context because Geschwister Scholl, as you know, there were resistance against the Nazis. It was a prize basically framed around resistance to tyranny, resistance to National Socialism. And when Mbembe received that prize, one can say that a certain kind of opening was taking place, that Holocaust consciousness was sort of like connected to that kind of black studies, which really didn't have a presence in Germany. And Mbembe gave a very beautiful speech. The Laudatio, the speech that praised Mbembe, was given by Paul Gilroy, which was also not accidental. The author who wrote like about the transatlantic and the black Atlantic and these things. And Gilroy started sort of like mapping out a big question. And he was asking his Munich audience who in reality is the oppressed. Is it the black person? Is it the slave? Or is it the Jew? And he was sort of like doing it. He was mapping it out. He was comparing it. Who are the refugees? Who are the oppressed? And it, in German consciousness, the concept of the Jew is, of course, big part of the grand moral narrative of the 20th century, which is the Holocaust, which is especially sort of like playing out in German public memory, in German politics, in German consciousness, in the whole cultural self-understanding of Germany, of course, is based on that. So the introduction of Achille Mbembe and the introduction of another figure as the principle of the oppressed was a kind of opening, as such it was conceived in Germany, in 2018, 2019, just before Corona broke out. And so it was not really surprising that Achille Mbembe received an invitation to open a very prestigious cultural festival. And then a shitstorm broke out. Really heavy-duty shitstorm. the person in German government in charge of sort of like anti-Semitism, it's a function that is located in the Ministry of Interior, doesn't really exist in other countries in that capacity, came out with a statement saying that Achille Mbembe is an anti-Zionist, an anti-Semite, and he should not be opening a publicly sponsored cultural event in Germany. Why is that? Because Achille Mbembe not only wrote a Critique of Black Reason and other, the Critique de la Raison Nègre and other books, but Achille Mbembe also wrote very, very strong political statements about apartheid, comparing Israel to an apartheid state, and being in many ways, and we are talking 2018, 19, 20, in many ways very, very critical of Israeli politics at that particular time, which rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. And the accusation of being an anti-Semite, of course, is a very serious accusation, especially in the German cultural and political context. And so the demand of him being disinvited became louder and louder. And what you had is a certain kind of what you call in Germany a Feuilletonkrieg, a war of the feuilletons. Then depends what paper you write for. If you write for a leftist paper, you're taking this position. If you write for a more conservative paper, you take another position. People were against him. People were in favor of him. Questions of free speech were discussed and all that. And then Corona canceled the festival and sort of like liberated everybody involved in that debate if he should be invited or disinvited because the whole festival was being canceled.
One question. But just for you to continue your talk, what was it? What provoked you especially in Achille Mbembe? You just mentioned that there were, of course, several reproaches toward him, and especially the so-called Antisemitismusbeauftragte Felix Klein. Kind of a czar fighting against anti-Semitism on behalf of the German state. He said that Achille Mbembe relativizes Holocaust and is a kind of anti-Zionist. I'm sure, I do know, that you don't have to share this assessment of Achille Mbembe's work, within which Israel doesn't play a big role. But what was it that you were provoked by in Mbembe's work?
I'm not sure I was provoked. I was triggered. I was triggered because I thought, I found the entire debate completely fascinating. And it made me think about actually what are these people arguing about? If you look sort of like, it came back to the two grand moral narratives of the 20th century. One sort of like moving from west to east, which is the narratives of the crimes of Stalinism and the crimes of National Socialism, which have sort of like preoccupied a lot of thinking about what is right and what is wrong and the morality and the politics of post-war World War II order and all that. But at the same time, of course, I was aware that there's another grand moral narrative, not moving from west to east, but moving sort of like from north to south, which is the narrative of colonialism and anti-colonialism. And it's, if I take these two lines, one moving from west to east and one moving from north to south, I think they both sort of like meet in the Middle East. And I thought maybe I should sort of like stage these debates in a certain way. I wasn't really interested at that particular time to figure out if Achille Mbembe was an anti-Semite or not. Because this is not a question that you can actually, you hardly find anti-Semites who sort of like think of themselves as anti-Semites. So the accusation, if somebody is an anti-Semite who says, I'm not an anti-Semite, I'm something else, they're sort of like lame discussions, I found. And they're not really interesting. And so I thought, I really want to look at this in a more broader way, sort of like looking at this from, if you like, from a sociology of knowledge kind of way. That's also why this guy Karl Mannheim is so extremely important for my work, because I was always interested in trying to figure out why people think politically the way they think, and that I think it's not only an act sort of like of moral lightning that we consider certain things as wrong or right, but there are other things like our biographies, our trajectories of our lives, and how they come into play. And I also, before I wrote that book, I was always fascinated by Hannah Arendt, in a sense that she changed her mind so often, which depended on political circumstances, which depended on the audience she was talking about. And actually, I started sort of like paddling back, building a huge stage where all these people appear, starting again with Franz and with Arendt's reading of the Dreyfus Affair, which also took place here in Paris, which is extremely important for Jewish thinking after the Dreyfus Affair, which completely changed the idea that you could be a French officer and a gentleman and he didn't protect you, and that all the promises of emancipation and enlightenment did sort of like go down the drain, and how to relate to it. I mean, if it's a Zionist idea, if it's a cultural autonomist idea, all these things that became later so relevant, not only for Jews, but for other minorities as well, I saw sort of like as the beginning here in Paris with the Dreyfus Affair, and also a feuilleton war, because this was the time when people started writing articles in the newspapers being for or against the Dreyfusard and the anti-Dreyfusard, and also Hannah Arendt's reading of that affair and her sort of like, she lived here in Paris, and René and I talked a little bit before our event here, sort of like how important Paris is for all the people that we talked about. She came to Paris in 1933 and lived here till 1940 and was very preoccupied with Jewish affairs, organizing the emigration of German Jewish kids to Palestine at that time, very involved in Jewish matters. She traveled to Geneva to be part of the opening of session of the World Jewish Congress. She was a very, very sort of like very conscious Jew here during her years in Paris. And Paris played an enormous role for her, because she felt so betrayed by it afterwards. It's no coincidence that her first essay that she wrote when she came to America is From Dreyfus to Vichy, because she's sort of like a straight line, especially for Jews in France, between Dreyfus and Vichy.
I think what's become clear is that you really stage a number of thinkers and authors in your book: Hannah Arendt, Franz Fanon, Claude Lanzmann, Albert Mimi, and others. But could you perhaps once more clarify the connection between you being triggered by this feuilleton war about Achille Mbembe on the one hand, and on the other hand, your staging of historical figures? I'm not sure if this connection has gotten clear enough.
I'm not sure it was clear for me, really. I mean, that's the point. I wanted to clarify things for me. I mean, this is, why do we write books? No, we want to sort of like clarify things for ourselves, who we are, especially when you get old, you do that. sort of like the books you write about yourself, and you pretend it's not about yourself.
What I did understand is that the question is, Achille, member, what does he really think? What does he really, what's his confession? Is he an anti-Semite, yes or no? This is not the question you were interested in.
No, I don't care.
Just for the record, I do not think that his work has anything to do whatsoever with anti-Semitism, but that's just my view. You are not interested in this question, but what was it you were interested in, starting off with the, with that debate?
I mean, as I said, I think to debate if someone is an anti-Semite or not is a lame debate. And that's true also for Achille Mbembe. Is he an anti-Semite? I don't think so. Was Konrad Adenauer, we just talked about it, who said in an interview that part of the reasons he wanted to make this agreement with the Jews in Israel because he know how powerful the Jews are. Is this an anti-Semitic statement or not? I mean, it could be, could not be. I mean, who can look into the heart of people and say that they're anti-Semitic or not? What we can say is that he was extremely critical of Israel, and so are many other people. That's not what characterizes somebody as anti-Semitic or not, especially not before October 7th. After October 7th, it's a little bit of another question, but we don't have to get into this right now. I wasn't really interested in it. I was interested why he wrote the things he wrote about Israel, why he wrote them in the way he wrote them, and why apartheid is such an important concept for the people looking at Israel, sort of why take a concept from South Africa and trying to transport it to another context. What is going on there? Does it have to do because apartheid is also connected with anti-apartheid, which is connected to boycott, which means that this might be a way of justifying boycott in a certain way. If the man himself was an anti-Semite or not, that was debated by others, not by me. I was not really interested. I thought his take on Israel extremely problematic at the time. I would give it another name because anti-Semitism is such a loaded term. And what is more important to me that I looked then, after I sort of like understood what Arendt was saying about the French, about when I looked at her life in Paris, her engagement with the Jews, how Paris has become such an important sort of like site for so many people. And I looked at the friendship, which I found extremely intriguing, between Frantz Fanon and Claude Lanzmann. These are not two people that you expect being close friends, but they were. And they were meeting on a playing ground that was also extremely important for Arendt, which is the critique of universalism, which is to be a proud particularist, to be critics of that French idea of being universal men. And of course they had to do this in French, which sort of like combined them also. And this is of course the catch, that you can only be critical within the terms of the things that you criticize. And for me, this was actually a key, because when you look at the genealogy of post-colonial thinking and their take on the Holocaust and their understanding of the Holocaust, I mean, you can start with Aimé Césaire and its discourse on colonialism. And I just saw this morning also in an exhibition here at the Centre Pompidou about Black Paris, which is also relating to Aimé Césaire and also to your James Baldwin, that when he said, you know, what the Nazis did to the Jews is not much different what white men did to black men in or black people in throughout history, which reminded me, of course, of what Member wrote, and that in Critique of Black Reason. And I thought this is an interesting take, because it sort of like started in many ways the topic of universalism, the universalization of Holocaust memory, the kind of comparison also, which for some people is extremely distasteful, for others it's a wonderful it's a good entry point into the debate, the debate which is very, very strong in Germany. If the Holocaust has been a unique event, it can be compared. And then the German version of it, if German colonialism in Namibia in the beginning of the 20th century is sort of like a beginning of the Holocaust, and if there's a causal relationship between colonialism and the Holocaust, which then of course triggered other people, because when you move in these kinds of debates, which started here in Paris, which is so fascinating, that they all started here in Paris, when you look at these debates, they move on an epistemological track, and they move on a political track, and you cannot very often sort of like separate them. So if you take in a high-powered graduate seminar and you teach a class on colonialism and the Holocaust, and then you look at Namibia and you look at other events and you look is there a causal relationship or not, how do they refer? Of course, people compare. This is what especially historians do. They compare. This is part of their business. And even if you come to the conclusion that the Holocaust was a unique event, you come to this conclusion that throughout comparison. But this is not enough. One sentence, and then I will get back to you then. We'll give it back to you. But if you do the comparison in order then to show, yes, there is a causal connection between colonialism and the Holocaust, and since Israel is basically a colonial entity, therefore, and then you draw sort of like political conclusions that Israel as a colonial entity is conducting certain kinds of deeds which can be compared. And since the Holocaust is not unique, you sort of like think that you take away one of the legitimate features of the State of Israel, which is the Holocaust, and you're in a completely different ballgame, the ballgame of politics, and not a ballgame of epistemological comparisons.
Yes, I do think so too. Expressions like colonial entity or some more expressions you used, I'm not so sure who you are quoting. And that's one of the reasons I would suggest, or I'm wondering if you'd like to talk a little bit about how you are staging, how your book is staging, for instance, Franz Fanon and Claude Lanzmann. Also, as an illustration, how your book works, just to show us how what you're doing with your figures or personnel. Both meet each other around 1960. They are both in their mid-30s. Fanon is already the author of Les Damnés de la Terre. Claude Lanzmann is not yet the director of Shoah. But what is that meeting? What is it you are elaborating with the both of them?
They met, they were young, they were fighting for France in World War II. It was Lanzmann who introduced Fanon to Sartre, which triggered, of course, Sartre to write his famous preface to the Damned of the World. But Lanzmann was more relating to White Mask, Black Face, to that book, where where Fénon sort of like explained in chapter 5, which is an extremely interesting chapter, especially when you look at the connections between racism and anti-Semitism, because Fénon in mid-1950s sort of like claimed that racism and anti-Semitism are certainly not the same, because racism has to do with visibility and anti-Semitism has to do with invisibility. And sort of like, and when they met, Lanzmann sort of like talked in his autobiography about how the statement has really fascinated him, and how they could relate to each other as opponents of a certain kind of French thinking at the time. I mean, they were both in favor of decolonization, and Lanzmann in that time, long before Shoah, his documentary, was thinking of Israel, of course, also in terms of decolonization, was thinking of Zionism as an anti-colonial movement, and was thinking of the Jews as an internally colonized people, and so could totally relate to Fénon. And it's fascinating to see, we're talking 1961, of course, it's before the occupation, and it's before the war of 67 and all the things that happened. But there was this idea, which you can also find in Du Bois and in and there we do the connection to Baldwin also, and Du Bois' sympathy to black, what he called black Zionism, sort of like what we can learn from the Zionists is sort of like to see Zionism as an emancipatory anti-colonial movement. And I show then later in the book how through Edward Said all this sort of like completely changed. But to give it to you, sort of like, I mean, the reason that it's not, you're not here to ask questions also, so I'm here to ask you a question. How does James Baldwin...
I'm full of questions.
How does James Baldwin fit into it? Because I saw in the exhibition today in Black Paris that he's like one of the heroes of that exhibition, and that the exhibition starts actually with a little video of him, and in the explanatory note of the exhibition, he's mentioned as he came to Paris in 48. Isn't that right?
That's right. I'd love to come back to James Baldwin, and I'd love to talk a little bit about James Baldwin in Paris, but I'd like to ask one last question for this section to you, because you just talked about Fanon and Lanzmann, and you mentioned this first book by Fanon. And within this first book by Fanon, and I guess it's in the same chapter you just mentioned, there's this thought which is very often quoted, that you as a black man, you have to mistrust everybody who talks devastatingly about Jews. Isn't there something like solidarity in this thought between black people and Jews?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, they were both considered not to be fully French.
Fully
French. That's why, again, Paris is so important, and the French connection is so important. And they sort of like, this is the level sort of like they could relate to each other. A level of solidarity that of course, I mean, Israel was a completely different country then, of course, also in 59 and in 60. But it wasn't really about Israel, even though one of the first movies that Lanzmann did long before Shoah is Pourquoi Israel. And in that movie, it's also an interesting point where they meet is... that in order to be free, you have to be sometimes using violence. That they both agree on in the late 19...
Fanon and Lanzmann.
And Lanzmann, yeah. That an emancipatory fight cannot be nonviolent. This is something that they could agree on. I mean, if we agree with it or not is another question, but the two of them sort of like agreed on that point. Now, how does James Baldwin fit in all of this?
Yeah, first of all,
I'm dying to know.
I guess this is a question I have to ask to you too, but I'd love to recall how James Baldwin arrived in Paris. This was indeed in 1948. In November of 1948, it was a gray day in New York City when he told his mother, "I'm leaving right now." He was 24 years old and left his mother and his siblings to take a plane to Paris and to become an author. He left because he feared for his life in New York City and in New Jersey, because he didn't feel secure, he didn't feel safe as a black person, threatened by the police, for instance, threatened because of this U.S. typical type of racism in the 1940s. He arrived here. Why did he? For him, it was more important to make this flight, to flee the U.S., more important than this aim, Paris. He once said, "I could have gone to Timbuktu, I could have gone to Israel even, but in fact it was Paris, once again the city of freedom, as you were talking about Paris just moments ago." And James Baldwin was part of a certain type of expat community here. And some of his expat colleagues were rather famous artists already.
Miles Davis,
not in that period, but even in that period, the late 1940s, so after post-war Paris, Richard Wright, the famous author, or Bofo Delany, the painter, and I'm sure you've seen pictures by Delany of James Baldwin within the exhibition. I haven't seen it yet. What might be interesting in this context, perhaps one or two thoughts. The first one is that there are several texts by James Baldwin within his first essay book, Notes of a Native Son, which really are concentrated about his first years in Paris. And I guess the main impression of his own life here was noticing that the French didn't see when they were interacting with him the Negro or the N-word, but they saw the black U.S. American, and this was a new kind of perception for him, not being the N-word, but being the U.S. American, the black American. This might be one aspect which is interesting, and a second aspect I'd like to mention is Baldwin not only wrote about his Paris years during the 1950s, but he also did so 20 years later, especially within parts of his great memoir book, No Name in the Street. And writing about himself in Paris with this distance of 20 years, there's an there are important parts that are reflecting on his interactions with the so-called North Africans, of course with the Algerians, but not only with the Algerians, but Baldwin talks about North Africans. And what he sees is that the so-called North Africans, have similar functions within the French state of the 50s and 60s as the African Americans have within the US. So this second aspect might stress the point that race, that the objects of racism aren't always the same. French racism has another fonctionnement than the US racism, and this is, I think, one of the points that are interesting in the Paris years of James Baldwin. But I'm not so sure if James Baldwin is one of the possible characters in your book. That's the question you have to answer. How does he fit in this series of characters?
I mean, it fits in many ways. There's this wonderful word in German, which is very difficult to translate, which Sehnsuchtsort, a site of longing, a place of longing, which is a place which really doesn't exist, but exists only in your imagination. And for many Jews, Paris was such a place of longing, especially after the Nazis came to power. When they all sort of like thought that in spite of Dreyfus, they might be safe in Paris. And they were not. I mean, in the end, it was the French police who sort of like collected them and put them into internment camps, which made Arendt write in her essay, "We Refugees, We Live in a World Where You Friends," sort of like parentheses, the French put you in internment camps and your enemies put you into extermination camps. So this kind of site of belonging, that there could be a place for us. If you're gay, if you're black, if you're Jewish, there could be a place for us. And for many, I thought that place is here. It's Paris. And I sort of like, every time I walk the streets here, sort of like think about this. Why is that? Is it because of the revolution? Is it because of other things? Is it because of emancipation? Is it because of the debates about Jews in the Assemblée Nationale, if they can be French citizens or not? And it was really a site of liberation as much as it was a site of oppression.
From the perspective of the 1930s.
Yeah, from the perspective and before. And if you sometimes when you listen to or you read in Miles Davis' autobiography, when he talks about his years here, working with Louis Malle and having an affair with Juliette Gréco, and all these things that he sort of like, I think he wrote once that Paris is the place where he's not looked upon as a black person, and he loved it there. And then he also, I mean, he sort of like returned, of course, to America the same way as Baldwin, and Arendt is also moving to America, and for that reason, I mean, one of the center chapters of my book is about Albert Mimi, and his sort of like distant love-hate relationship with Paris.
Just before you talk about Albert Mimi, what you say about Miles Davis, similar things are of course true of James Baldwin. For him, his first Paris years were not romantic. He was extremely poor, but he was relatively free. He was freer than he was in New Jersey. He was freer than he was in New York City. He met his first and most important lover, a Swiss young guy, 17-year-old, called Lucien Appert-Berbeguer, or I'm not sure how he would be pronounced in French. Things which weren't possible in the same way even in Greenwich Village in New York City for him. But that doesn't, of course, that doesn't mean that Paris was at the time post-war Paris, the 1950s in this case, that doesn't mean that this, that Paris was a kind of racism-free zone. It wasn't. But the point is that James Baldwin saw that, of course, there was racism in different shades, and that he wasn't the only object, not the privileged object, but that even racism is flexible and relative to time and space, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, in the old days when I was still teaching, I taught a seminar on anti-Semitism and racism, and the first text I was teaching there was a text by Georg Simmel, The Stranger, of course. And the second text I was teaching was James Baldwin, A Stranger in a Swiss Village. And that's the only Baldwin reference I have in the book, is a footnote to that beautiful text, because as René said, he met his Swiss lover here, and they came to his lover's Swiss village, which was sort of like behind the Seven Mountains, somewhere far away, and he was sitting there in that Swiss village, and apparently the first and only black person ever been in that village, and he sort of like this. He writes that essay in such an amused way, in many ways, sort of like when the children were running and they were sort of like touching him, if the color goes, if they put the finger, if the color would disappear, and they touched his hair, and he sort of like was comparing it to, you know, the way he was looked upon in Harlem. And I was so, of course, comparing it to Simmel's Stranger, because Simmel's Stranger, which is a very short reflection of what it means to be a secular Jew in Germany at the beginning of the 20th century, where you sort of like an invisible Jew. And again, what Fanon was saying about visibility and invisibility, and that Baldwin could not escape his visibility, whereas Georg Simmel in Berlin could walk the streets of Berlin and be completely invisible as a Jew, which made him much more dangerous in many ways. And Simmel has this definition: a stranger is a person who comes today and stays tomorrow, and he's not sort of like an alien from out of space, but he's part and not part of society.
And if I could remember correctly, Simmel also says, or this text also says, that stranger, that Simmel stranger, sees more than society can see itself, because he is the stranger. He has a wider horizon.
Yeah, distant relationship.
This,
yeah.
Yeah, this is also very close to one of the thoughts in Baldwin's Stranger in the Village, because he not only describes how he is dehumanized, at the same time, in the same motion, if you will, he becomes the subject who describes the villagers within their white wilderness, meaning he is a kind of an anthropologist who analyzes the white wilderness, and I guess this is rather close to this.
Yeah, of course.
Thought once again, me asking: is there some solidarity between those two different lines?
Yeah,
of thoughts?
That's why I taught them together. Of course, I mean. This, and I told you that, but don't know that I told you that already. And yes, and Perhaps if I may. Taxi strike, no? Yeah, okay.
If I may, when we are listening to your question, provoked or you being triggered by Achille Mbembe in Germany, when we recall what you are doing, staging all those thinkers, authors, figures, characters, there's one big question that comes to mind. What are your conclusions for your view on current events, on politics today? There are some paragraphs in your book, for instance, about the meaning of never again. What are your thoughts about this?
That's a tough one. But before I start answering it, I really wanted to talk about Albert Mimi.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. I really wanted to talk about Albert Mimi because sort of like he was the big, you know, when sometimes you write a book, you don't know where it's going to lead you. And oh la la. All right. we can continue, no? Yes, okay. No worry. They won't come in. Okay. You don't know exactly where it's going to lead you. And I thought, yeah, Albert Mimi, he's important. I might sort of like integrate him into a chapter where I write about Césaire and other Fénon and other anti-colonial writers. And the more I started reading him, the more he started to fascinate me. And then he died on me during the writing, sort of like, because he almost became 100 years old and he died in 2020, exactly when I was writing about him. And I thought, now it's the time that to give him a chapter, and not only a chapter, but the central chapter. So in the architecture of the book, sort of like everything is leading to the chapter to Mimi, and then there's this central pillar of Mimi, and then it leads away from Mimi to current events. And why was I so fascinated by Mimi that I was writing this, by the way, during Corona. I was sharpening up my passive French because there's so many texts by Mimi that I couldn't find in translation. I didn't want to read him in translation, so I started reading him in French, which meant that I read him extremely slowly, but never mind, it was Corona and there was nowhere to go anywhere. So there was a, and I love the idea that someone could write great sociology, wonderful novels, newspaper articles, essay, the whole enchilada. And when I was sort of like reading his novel, The Pillar of Salt, which is one of the best treatments of what it means that you want to be and what you can be. He was born in Tunisia. He was sort of like the Nazis actually came to Tunisia and he was sort of like suffering from the Nazis. He became part of the anti-colonial Tunisian movement. They didn't really want him because he was Jewish. So he left Tunisia and went to Paris. Again, Paris. And here he was unhappy because it was too French for him. And he was sort of like, at the same time, something that seems almost impossible today, and we're talking about current events and solutions and all that. Albert Mimi was a Jew, he was an Arab, he was a Tunisian, he was French, he was African, he was European, he was a Zionist, he was an anti-Zionist, and he was all these things together. And that's also why I sort of like the titles of my chapters, or was the impossible life of. the impossible life of Arendt, the impossible life of Lanzmann, the impossible life. But for Mimi, it really was an impossible life because he really tried to be all of these things and he understood that he couldn't be neither of them. And how do you live with that? If you want to be Jew, Arab, Tunisian, French, European, African, and you want to be all these things together. You want them to hold them together. And what I found fascinating that when you look today at textbooks at post-colonialism, Albert Mimi is completely written out. He's not there because he doesn't fit the categories anymore. You can't really put him in any boxes. So this is the center pillar. And from Mimi, I moved to the impossible life of Edward Said. And in this is where it shifted from Paris to New York. And after independence of North African states and the Jews who left either to France or to Israel, there wasn't really much writing about Algeria anymore and Tunisia and Morocco and all these places. And Said made a huge impact of putting Israel into the center of anti-colonial thinking. When beforehand one could still consider sort of like Zionism as an emancipatory movement, an anti-colonial movement, in the wake of those Francophone thinkers, after Said, sort of like this was not possible anymore. Things have changed also historically. Said was writing this very important Foucaultian book influenced by Foucault, Orientalism, that every student now in cultural studies knows very good. But in 77, and then in 78, he sort of like followed with another book called The Question of Palestine, where he sort of like applied Orientalism to the Palestinian question. And it makes perfect sense. I mean, he was a refugee from Jerusalem, a Palestinian, of course, a high-powered professor at Columbia University, my alma mater. And I remember him when I was still a graduate student at Columbia. I was not studying with him because I was studying sociology and not literature. He was in the literature department, but he was sometimes sort of like walking across campus and this is Edward Said, sort of like, and everybody was very much in awe of him, also because Columbia University, I mean, everybody is dressed so badly. That's such a schlumper university, sort of like from the students and the professors and all that, because it's sort of like New York Ivy League. We don't have to dress up. But Edward Said was always sort of like the leather shoes, the three-piece suits, sort of like he was dressed to kill, as people say. His impact was enormous in the question of putting Israel into the camp of a European colonial movement. He understood Zionism as a European colonial movement and not as a movement of emancipation. He completely ignored sort of like the Oriental Jewish community in Israel. He looked at Israel as something completely European. And I think sort of like it had an impact on current debates, when you ask about current debates and how to look at Israel in many ways, which I understand is extremely problematic and all that, but I'm sort of like beyond sort of like the current politics. I was really interested to see how this whole paradigm of settler colonialism was developing in the 1970s and in the 1980s, and how it sort of like moved away from those Francophone thinkers based in Paris and became a completely different trajectory.
When I'm, no, perhaps one, this sense, I have one or two or three more questions, but I'd like to invite you to ask questions to Nathan Schneider after that too.
And to René about that, Baldwin.
That's not so necessary. But just as a kind of heads up, when I'm listening to you talking about Albert Memmi, I was thinking to myself, wow, that could be the hero for you, your hero in that book, central figure, center of the book. Arab and Jew, Zionist and anti-Zionist, at least you used the word, for Memmi.
European African?
Yeah, and so on. And that's peak pluralism, pluralism in excess, if you want to. And yeah, listening to you, I was thinking to myself, perhaps that's his hero. Reading your book, on the other hand, I was not so sure if Albert Memmi is your hero, because your book time and again says that you are looking for a very sharp, particular or particularist perspective, namely Jewish Israeli. So what is it? Is it true that Memmi is kind of a hero for you, or one, the central figure, because he is so this kind of pluralistic figure? And if so, what's the relationship between this view and your attempt to find a very particularist perspective?
Well, I feel like in therapy here. that's a very, yeah, it's a personal question, but it's also a political question. It's very good. And yes, Memmi has never stopped fascinating me. And I read this little essay from the 1960s called Negritude et Juidité. And he invented this concept that I didn't translate in the book. Maybe the only word in that book that I sort of like spared the translator to translate, the Judaite, and where he sort of like, again, the solidarity, where he took the concept of negritude, which was around in the French Parisian debate of black Paris. You can see this also in the exhibition, that concept of negritude, and sort of like translated it into a kind of Jewish cultural identity as well. He wanted sort of like to combine these two concepts. And I was looking at Memmi, of course, from the side, sort of like, as I said, I'm like a puppeteer. I let them appear on stage. But I was looking at Memmi as, let's say, a son of Holocaust survivors, as somebody who has sort of like no family because they were all killed by the Nazis, as someone who grew up in Germany and decided more than 50 years to emigrate to Israel. And I was sort of like conversing with him. I was talking to him and said, you know, I mean, I cannot be a Jew and Arab and European and African because I'm not. You know, I'm sort of like I'm basically an Eastern European Jew whose entire family was wiped out by the Nazis and decided to become sort of like political by moving to Israel. And as much as I admire what he is, I also sort of like, I'm completely saddened by the fact that I cannot be like that. And sort of like, and my concept, and maybe with that we wrap up, sort of like to let other people in. My concept was that I came, what I imagined is that I visited people. I came to visit them. I visited Fanon, I visited Said, I visited Mimi, I visited people I agree with, I visited people I don't agree with. I come to their house, I look around, I observe what they put on the walls, what they put on the table. I sit with them, have a cup of tea, and then I go home and close the door behind me. This is basically what this book is about. Thanks.
I see. Before there's questions from the public, I'd like to make a second try with my question on Never Again. What are your thoughts on Never Again? Because you do have deep thoughts about that in your book. And really thinking about current events too. After you published this book, there's been this devastating October 7th event. And after that, there's this devastating war still, devastating land and people. So what does that mean, Never Again, after thinking through so many authors?
I'm silenced by it in many ways. Sort of like I have my thoughts. I'm silenced because I don't understand actually what's going on. I know what's going on is horrible, both for us and for the other side. And it frightens me. I'm more frightened than anything else, because I really saw and believed that Zionism was a movement for freedom for the Jews. I really believed it was an emancipatory movement, and I didn't expect that it comes with a price like that.
Okay, thank you. Until this point, are there questions?
Question in English or?
In German.
Kann sein. Nathan, bonsoir.
Bonsoir.
I've almost finished your book. Thank you for it. In the introduction, you used the term competition of memory, victimhood, etc. I found it in the introduction that you wrote for the French edition. You know, I'm not sure I found it in the rest of your very compelling and very moving and very interesting book. Competition of memory, of representation, you know, Holocaust, colonialism, Israel as a colonial state. As the colonial representation definitely won over the genocide or Holocaust one?
Like I said, I don't know. I mean, I tried in that book very consciously to go beyond competition, because I find competition boring in ways of I'm a victim, I'm a bigger victim, you know, sort of like these kind of things. I also don't believe from an epistemological point of view that being a victim or being oppressed gives you any kind of epistemological advantage. René might not agree because he likes Foucault, but I think that Foucault has put us into a quagmire that in the belief that being oppressed gives you any kind of advantage. I also don't believe that being in power gives you any kind of epistemological advantage, but being oppressed doesn't make you right, doesn't make you true. That's why the competition of victims is, for me, is boring, because I don't care who wins. Because I don't think that the winner of that competition has any kind of advantage. I thought in that book that I could dissolve the competition, because I don't think that truth lies in being oppressed or truth lies in being in power, but I think that truth lies in conversation. In conversation between people who are willing to share a common world. This is, I think, where truth is to be found. Not as something Kantian from above, but something that develops in talks, especially between people who don't agree with each other. Sort of like send your mind visiting. That's why I find the idea of visiting so much. I'm being punished right now for that kind of thinking by the brutality of reality. And the brutality of reality puts me in a position also where I, as a citizen of a country, also not only have to take personal responsibility for the things being done in the name of my country, but also because in many ways I see the powerlessness of thought in times which are so dark that are really sort of like I'm born 54, and I'm sort of like feel like I'm being put back into a time that I thought is behind us. And I'm sort of like catapulted back into dark times that I don't want to, and I see the powerlessness. And as much like, you know, give you a concrete example, I mean sort of like the demonstrations in Israel every Saturday for the last year and a half about the release of the hostages. We go there every week, every Saturday, and scream the same slogans. Release them now, stop the war now, do this. And you know, and along comes Donald Trump and does what he does. And we look, you know, and say, well, what should I do now? Should I put a red hat on my head and say, you know, thank you, Mr. Trump, sort of like a lot of hostages did when they were released on his behalf in many ways. Sort of like as an intellectual, if I may sort of like think of myself as that, I feel so helpless and powerless that I won't write another nonfiction book anymore. I'm only going to write novels from now on, sort of like in order not to have to deal with these questions.
Right. Well, thank you very much. I maybe have a question that is a little more lighthearted, which is about Paris. I also went to visit the Paris Noir exhibition a couple of days ago. And what struck me about it is that the imagination of Paris for artists coming from the US kind of lines up with the European or maybe also global imagination of Paris as such. It's not only, you know, black artists from the US who had this vision of the Quartier Latin. It's everybody. I mean, there's, you know, the idea of Paris as the capital of the République of literature. So I was wondering to what way you really think, and that's a question maybe directed at both of you, that Paris as a particular place for instance, either Jewish intellectuals or black artists from the US, or whether it's really something that is shared more broadly.
In the present or history? I'd really like you to start, because I haven't even seen this exhibition yet. I have to do it tomorrow. As far as I understand your question, you're perfectly right, in my opinion. I guess that's the case. What I can do is to try and give one or two associations around life and work of James Baldwin, because as I just recalled, he arrived here by the end of the 40s, and he was part of a community along with a lot of people who don't have famous names, but along of whom are Beaufort Delany or Richard Wright. And of course, they too were in the Café Flore, Les Deux Magots, and all those places that are kind of universalized for many, many decades. And although their lives were not a romantic dream, not at all, they were already people who kind of repeated something which was already there during the 40s, because of course they were only the new lost generation, because there was one lost generation of Americans, of US Americans in Paris here 10 or 20 or 30 years earlier, Hemingway, Stein and all that. These would be my first associations. And yes, of course, I guess this kind of Paris is a kind of a free-floating sign, which is universalized for eternities.
Yeah, and yes and no. Because clearly Paris is this point de fuite, this vanishing point. It is. Clearly, I mean, when the Nazis came to power and you were Jewish and you want to go away somewhere, you want to run away, where else to go than Paris? I mean, that's the place you go. I mean, this is where, you know, do you have that famous picture of Walter Benjamin in the National Library, you know, taken by Giselle Freund, who was also, you know, a student of Karl Mannheim and Norbert Elias, and also had to leave and came to Paris, where she sort of like photographed Benjamin in the library, and that picture says so much. This is where you want to be, Paris. And for those people, for Benjamin, for Arendt, for many other Jews, the sense of betrayal, the French police coming to arrest, the internment camps, Gurs and others. And that was hard to take. And there were sort of like, we haven't talked about 1961 and October 1961 here in Paris, where sort of like a lot of detainees were finding themselves at the Vélodrome, at the same place that Jews were put in. And all this was sort of like orchestrated by Papon and all this. But it's all in the book, and it's late. And so yes, Paris is that point of fuite in many ways. Yes.
We're having one last question and then wrap up.
Eine Bemerkung und eine Frage. Was Sie zum Schluss diskutiert haben, ich denke, wenn man die Geschichte des Quartier Latin und die Geschichte der Universität bis in die Anfänge der Universität zurückverfolgt, findet man Antwortelemente. Denn in Paris wurde die Universität, wie wir sie heute noch erleben und hoffentlich retten können, gegründet. Und da ging eine geistige Ideenbewegung los, die habe ich in Ihrer Diskussion wieder gespürt. Die Frage wäre zu dem, was Sie über die Gewalt gesagt haben, könnte man nicht einfach sagen, auch Ihre Hoffnungslosigkeit zum Schluss, dass man einfach weiter darum ringen sollte, die Gewalt auf verbale Gewalt, auf Dialektik, rhetorische Dialektik, intellektuelle Dialektik herunterzubrechen und sich nicht entmutigen zu lassen von den Ereignissen?
I mean, this is what we do tonight, no? In many ways, isn't it? Huh? Ah, now we have to translate the question. that we should not give up, that we should sort of like have put ourselves into the hope that violence can be sort of like constructively transformed into reasonable discourse, if I understood you right. And I said, yes, I mean, in a way, this is what we do today or tonight. Sort of like lots of hopes I don't have, to be honest. These are really dark times, and I'm sometimes, these are the moments when I'm happy that I'm old. And I don't envy you young people, really don't. Okay, on that happy note.
Wow. Considering the enormity of all these topics, this conversation could only be a starting point. I guess we have to finish nevertheless, I guess. Thank you for your questions. Thank you for the conversation, Nathan. Thank you for listening to us. Thank you. Good evening.